Welcome to the Architectural History Podcast, a podcast dealing with histories of architecture in the built environment. In our first series, Architecture And, we speak to a number of academics, architects, writers and thinkers to discuss space, buildings and cities, and to think through contemporary debates and issues. Hi, Matt.
Hello, Jess. How are you doing?
I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. So, Jess, you put together this episode of the podcast. What are we talking about for this one?
So this episode, we're talking about architecture and energy, or more specifically, architecture and the climate crisis. I mean, 2021 has really highlighted the climate emergency as the most pressing issue of our time. In November, we had the UN Climate Change Conference, COP26 in Glasgow, which was billed as sort of the last chance to get a plan in place to get climate change under control. Who knows how that will then play out? But back in June 2021, the SAHGB's annual symposium also took on this issue of climate change and architecture. So for this episode, we invited some of the speakers from the symposium to speak about what architectural history and research in architecture more broadly can contribute to our understanding and our efforts to tackle the climate emergency.
Yeah, it feels very prescient, this episode, or it feels very timely. So who did we get along to talk to about this question?
So we're going to start with Barnabas Calder, who is Senior Lecturer in Architecture at Liverpool University. And we're going to talk about his work in architecture and energy in the sort of long durée of architectural history.
I started thinking about what the big questions were facing architecture today and to what extent they would potentially have a relevant position in rethinking architectural history or thinking of a particularly kind of worthwhile angle on architectural history. And it struck me more and more as I read around it that the biggest question we're dealing with today is energy use in architecture, because 39% of carbon emissions are the result of building and running architecture. Construction and running of buildings. And this is an enormous proportion of the climate crisis that we're providing. And energy is right at the center of that. 80% of anthropogenic climate change emissions are from fossil fuel consumption for energy. So I started wondering about how that projected backwards and looking into energy history, and found that, in fact, it was not just the biggest question today, it's always been the biggest question. It, throughout architectural history, the single biggest influence, the single most important shaping factor in everything.
Maybe, I know this is a hard task, but maybe could you pick one example from the book that captures this argument or your perspective on architecture and energy?
Well, the first one I ever did as a back of the envelope calculation was to think about energy consumption in the biggest ancient monuments. So I had a look at the Pyramid of Khufu. I looked at the range of archaeologists' guesses or estimates based on calculations of how it was built and the labor requirements for getting that 5 and a bit million tons of stone heaped up and shaped. And if I took a kind of mid estimate of that, because there's a range of estimates provided by archaeologists, I found that if you added up all that labor and turned it into an energy calculation, the total energy consumption required to build the largest of all the Egyptian pyramids was only the amount of energy that 7 average American citizens will today get through in their lifetime. So the level of energy wealth we now have in any extended family in the rich world is equivalent to the richest, the most energy wealthy person in the whole of ancient history, possibly. And that really shocked me and really jarred me and got me sensitized to our current situation, as well as to reviewing the whole of older architectural history in the light of heat poverty, where until fossil fuels become widespread from about 1600 in England and then spreading around the world, essentially carrying modernity with them. Until that great change, human history is a history of heat poverty and agrarian history, the period after the invention of farming and the large states that eventually follow that, agrarian big civilizations with small elites of rulers and religious figures, their history is one of very cheap labor and very expensive heat. And when you start looking at their architecture, it makes total sense in those terms. There are almost no heat inputs in the pyramid of Khufu's construction, and truly vast, tens of thousands of laborers working for tens of years, possibly, because labor was extremely cheap in those circumstances. And our current situation is so exactly the opposite. We have very cheap fossil fuel heat and very expensive labor that we really struggle to understand what's special about ancient buildings in the terms that the ancients themselves would have seen it.
We were talking before this podcast, and you were talking about, you know, the history of fossil fuels in terms of architecture is essentially a positive one. But obviously then the knock-on effect has been so damaging. How did you deal with that in the book?
Yes, I found myself in the position of that Blake describes of Milton, that that he inadvertently ends up on the side of the devil in Paradise Lost, because the devil's so much more exciting and moves things on so much more than the good characters. And that's very much the case with this book, that Cole, which is, of course, the great villain in bringing fossil fuels to the world before oil took over as the biggest source of fossil fuel. Coal and oil are also the things that generated so much that's good about modernity in architecture and beyond, but our enormous quantity of good quality fireproof buildings that perform to a level of comfort and safety that's totally unknown to ordinary people's buildings for most of the rest of history, it's very hard not to see that as a good thing. It's our improving architecture increasingly around the world. It has brought public health improvements, quality of life improvements that are significant and not to be sniffed at. And my book, in some ways, is a sort of guilty celebration of fossil fuels, as well as a terrified plea for us to move away from them. I think in the good news category, a lot of the progress we've made on things like human rights and equality and social justice, which obviously is a very, very incomplete and inadequate set of improvements, but nevertheless huge since agrarian times, a lot of that progress doesn't need to be reversed in order to, and can indeed continue to progress, but we need to find careful ways of designing our sustainable future that doesn't throw away the wonderful things we've got from fossil fuels at the same time as the potentially life-annihilating carbon emissions.
So what can architectural history teach us about reuse in architecture?
Perhaps most importantly of all, keeping all our existing buildings, unless there's a very pressing reason not to, and working with what we've already got. Sometimes keeping their aesthetic as well, sometimes changing it quite radically for functional or cultural reasons. But the fundamentals of keeping fabric when you can that were totally normal to the pre-fossil fuel world, with things like the Castel Sant'Angelo being the nth version of things going on in Hadrian's mausoleum. And it's the same stones being given different meanings and different functions over a period of a couple of thousand years, time and again. But the stones remain the same, even when the cultural meaning and the function changes. And we do the exact opposite. We do things like, for the design museum, keeping a bit of roof because we want culturally to assert a connection to it. But meanwhile, we demolish the entire interior and all the surroundings and dig a new hole underneath it and put an entirely new carbon-intense building into it. Because what we're currently doing is sort of culturally sympathizing with heritage, but physically replacing as much as we can. Gut and stuff is still alive and well and environmentally disastrous.
So a broad question here, but do you think your book is optimistic about the future of architecture?
It's agnostic about the future because we're at the decision point around now. Ideally, we'd have come to the decision point around 1980, but we didn't. And therefore, we're now at the point where we have these important decisions to make about whether we want to achieve zero carbon or not. At the moment, we're mostly taking the actions that suggest we're deciding not to. So in those terms, I'm very pessimistic. If you look at things like contemporary government policy, which doesn't even require you to measure your embodied carbon of the materials and processes that go together to make up your new building, let alone to reduce it, And that is lunacy. And similarly, we don't have any restriction on demolition from an environmental point of view. There's only heritage restrictions on demolition of existing buildings, when in fact we should be preserving them if they can be reused, because the wastage of carbon, both already spent carbon building them in the first place and the new spend carbon of demolishing them and replacing them, is just insane. And, you know, how many plastic bags do you need to remember to take to the supermarket before you've paid off the energy consumption of one modest size new speculative office development replacing a 1960s speculative office development? Is just a disastrous, lunatic thing, the rate at which we're demolishing existing buildings. So at the moment, we're heading towards planetary disaster, but that's a matter of choice. We are currently choosing disaster, but we don't have to. And if the will gets up to avoid it, then the techniques are there by and large. The cultural battle of persuading people that this is real, that we need to take action and what action we need to take, is enormous. But I think architectural history has a real contribution to make in teaching the profession and the wider public about this. And this is buildings are a very powerful, and architectural history is a very powerful way of communicating these issues to people. There's something very intuitive about the difference between a medieval wooden structure and a Georgian brick house that people know enough about and are struck enough with for you really to be able to get across the changes that fossil fuels have brought about. So I would say that there are hugely cheering things that we can take from the past, including the rate and totalness of some of the past changes. If you look at the move in English architectural history from flammable buildings of the medieval and early modern period to Georgian brick buildings, it's very, very swift, largely through good regulation. After the fire of London, the fire of Warwick, and other major 17th century fires, you just stop building in flammable wood and you start building in durable fireproof materials. And that's a regulatory change that changes all practice overnight. And we can therefore do the same again in reverse, not to go back to wattle and daub, but to go back to low carbon or no carbon or even carbon sequestering materials. We can do it if we want to, very quickly and easily. The other thing that I find encouraging is looking at the extent to which our current architectural assumption that a building is a massive quantity of very energy intense materials is not inevitable. When you look at a contemporary building, almost everything that goes into it has been processed through intense fossil fuel heat: cement, steel, glass, aluminium, and so on. And lots of plastics. About a quarter of all plastics go into buildings. And this extraordinary habit we've got into of processing everything with our very intense cheap heat and then often transporting it around most of the planet using diesel fuel is completely unnecessary. And when you look back at the past of architecture, when heat was expensive and labor was cheap, the heat inputs to the great monuments of the past are astonishingly low. So if you look at the Baths of Caracalla in ancient Rome, one of the biggest of all Roman monuments, the wonderful Janet Delane has done extraordinarily good and exciting and important reverse quantity surveying essentially on that building. She spoke at the SAHGB conference as one of the keynotes, and it was absolutely show-stopping. And her findings are that in the Baths of Caracalla, under 6% of the building is made up of materials that required heat to produce, which is incredibly low compared with today's buildings. And that building has survived for thousands of years now, nearly 2,000 years. Over 76% of the building's materials came from within 20 kilometers of the site. So the transport energy involved was microscopic compared with today's buildings, where we transport things systematically thousands of miles from factory to site. And if they can do that in the low energy, low technology terms of ancient Rome, in a city that was struggling under its own size and its own grotesque excessive building boom, how can we not manage to do that with our astonishing levels of technological understanding and engineering mastery? And the answer is we absolutely can. We just aren't I think people don't think it's as achievable as it is. And the past shows us both that regulation is quick acting, deeply effective. And shortly afterwards, no one's looking back and wondering whether the life was better before. And secondly, that a low carbon architecture doesn't mean that everything needs to be flimsy and flammable. You can have very solid, very long-lasting, very fireproof, very beautiful, very exciting architecture without our current absolute dependency on enormous amounts of fossil fuels.
What I thought was really striking about Barnabas's kind of agenda there and his political, historical vision is that fossil fuels and the kind of wide availability of fossil fuels in the 20th century brought with it huge advances in quality of life, and that it's going to be a real struggle in architecture and beyond to wean ourselves off them whilst maintaining that quality of life, but also simultaneously that the kind of massive surplus of energy, completely unprecedented in history, has led to a lot of waste. And that we've been able to design buildings that are like mechanically ventilated and huge deep plans artificially lit, and that we can reclaim some of the sort of lessons of history in terms of how to build in a more energy efficient and sustainable way. I think that's a very powerful message of Barnabas's work generally.
Absolutely. So this comes out even further in the discussion with our next contributor. Mary Shepperson is lecturer in architecture and urban heritage at Liverpool University. And I spoke to her about her research into the architecture of ancient Mesopotamia.
I think many people will know that ancient Mesopotamia is kind of known as the birthplace of cities. And that's really its major significance, is that it's the earliest area where we see what we would now understand as truly sort of urban life emerging. Before that, it was mostly just village life, essentially. And when settlements got too big, they tended to fission and part of the population would move away and form another settlement. But for some reason, during the late 4th into 3rd millennium BC, we get this emergence of much larger settlements. But once you get into the 3rd millennium, you've got these large magnitude, high density settlements that I think most people would understand as cities. At the same time, you also have the emergence of centralized institutions, which also were absent from previous smaller settlements. Most importantly, in the very earlier cities, you get the establishment of temples as one of the major organizing and central institutions. Sometimes these very earliest cities are known as temple economies because the temples seem to so dominate them. But what this also meant was it was the emergence of large monumental institutional architecture as well. And again, this is one of the earliest areas where we see this kind of architecture occurring.
So can you tell us a bit about what the conditions were during this period that are impacting on architecture?
Well, so like most ancient architecture, it's really a combination of climate and the available resources. And the Mesopotamian plain, so this is the plain that was created by the two rivers, Mesopotamia meaning between the two rivers of the Tigris and Euphrates, formed a large alluvial plain, which is now mostly in Iraq, but also extends into Syria and also a little into Turkey. But on this plain, there was a particular combination of climatic and resource limitations. So the climate there was essentially hot and arid, and obviously there's no air conditioning or anything like that. So this meant that passive design became extremely important in the creation of these cities. And the form that these cities took in terms of passive design was so effective that essentially it set the entire pattern for urbanism in most of the Middle East that persisted up until really the 20th century, when it became replaced by more modern layouts and concepts to do with the introduction of cars and things like that. So really, this was an incredibly successful type of urbanism that was so successful that it lasted for essentially 5,000 years. And that passive design kind of consisted of very high density, as I said before, which provided mutual shading between the buildings. So you had very little open space, which exposed elevations of buildings to sun and heat gain. And overall, it created a smaller surface area through which heat could be absorbed. So by putting the houses back to back and with very, very few gaps in between, the overall surface area is much, much smaller. And essentially, you're only getting sunlight onto the roofs of the buildings. It also led to the introduction of courtyard houses. And again, Mesopotamia is one of the earliest places that we see true courtyard houses emerging. Again, the courtyard house, it's a great adaptation to the climate. So you can have all of the elevations for the building are mostly within the courtyard, which is overwhelmingly shaded during most of the day, most of the year. And it allows you to have a closed outer shell, which doesn't allow the hot air and dust and the negative parts of the climate in very easily. And again, this, the courtyard housing is something that persists for 5,000 years up until the early 20th century. The Mesopotamian plain was also very short on resources. So it was a great place to grow crops to support your population. Once you put in the appropriate amount of irrigation, then you could get very high agricultural yields. But it was very short on a lot of other resources. So there was no stone for most of the plain was very far away from any good stone sources. Also with wood, because again, the mountains are a long way away, and also metal. All of these things were not available to the builders in this region and could only be got in small quantities through trade. So essentially, building in Mesopotamia was limited to clay and reeds. Reeds are known to have been used very similar to how they are by modern marsh Arabs, but we have very little archaeological evidence except for pictorial evidence for reed buildings. However, mud brick and baked bricks are the absolute essential building blocks for ancient Mesopotamian cities. Mud brick was just made from the alluvial clay of the plain and sun-dried and then built to make quite adaptable plastic kind of architecture that could be added to, subtracted, and changed very easily. It was also, again, extremely good for the climate, as unbaked mud brick absorbs heat very slowly and then emits it very slowly during the underheated part of the day. Baked bricks, on the other hand, they had obviously the advantages of durability, but there was a big problem because they required an awful lot of fuel to make them. And fuel on the Mesopotamian plain was, again, quite scarce, having no access to forested areas. So essentially, fuel was mostly came in the form of animal dung, so animal dung made into fuel cakes. As Barnabas was talking about with ancient buildings having a very low carbon footprint in terms of the fuel that they consumed, baked bricks actually do consume quite a lot of fuel in terms of carbon input to make them. So they were quite high energy and therefore quite expensive. And yes, limited to individuals and institutions that had access to a large amount of animal herds and flocks to produce the fuel. So most buildings that were made with baked bricks were institutional buildings, so temples and palaces, although we do get richer private individuals also making their houses sometimes completely from baked bricks, but often just the lower parts of the walls were made from baked bricks and then topped with unbaked mud brick.
So you've talked about the sort of climate conditions and the resources that create the conditions of this place and time. Is there a particular building that shows the impact of these on architecture?
Well, I worked on a project in southern Iraq near to the ancient city of Ur, which is close to the modern city of Nasiriyah, at a site called Tel Kaiba, which is a building from about 1500 BC, and it's a large institutional building. I worked on this for five seasons in the field. So when I say worked on, I mean digging it out of the ground. So we found that the building, really unusually, was from a kingdom called the Sealand Kingdom, which is a kingdom that was previously only known about from textual sources. It's a small kingdom that broke away from the Babylonian kingdom in the early second millennium BC. It was at war, sort of fighting for its existence against this larger neighbor for its whole existence. But no building had been found from this kingdom, dating to this kingdom previously. This was the very first one. We knew that it dated to the Sealand Kingdom and was part of that kingdom because we found an archive of cuneiform texts, which were excavated from the building and dated to these kings. And as we excavated it, we came to realize that it was a very, very unusual Mesopotamian building. But this building was unusual in several ways, but most unusual in that it didn't really use courtyards. The main part of the building, and this is a very large building, covers around 4,500 square meters. Most of this building was based around three passageways, so open corridors, like unroofed corridors. And the whole structure of the internal organization was incredibly dense and made up of these multiple small rooms that all opened off of these three passageways. And this is a completely bizarre situation for a large Mesopotamian building. So we were really interested to know why it had been built in this way. And it seems that because it was built by the Sealand Kingdom, which was under this constant threat, it's clear that it was built as a fortress. So it's extremely heavily defended with a huge mud brick outer wall with large towers embedded in it. But it's also entirely made of unbaked mud brick, so there's no baked brick in it at all. So what we seem to have is a building that was built in an emergency situation. So they had no resources to make baked bricks. They had no resources to bring in materials from outside. So they had to build it. It seems they had to build it quickly, and they had to build it entirely with local resources. They couldn't bring anything from outside. And they also had to make it as small as possible, hence the compact internal organization. And that's why they adapted the normal Mesopotamian organization of a building around courtyards into this completely novel three passageway system. There seems to have been quite a lot of extensive measures within the building, though, to mitigate some of the changes that the different internal layout meant for the Mesopotamian occupants of the building. Because they had to cram so many people into this accommodation block, they clearly needed to add extra privacy measures. So the two side corridors don't reconnect to anything. They just end in a dead end. So essentially it makes two private neighborhoods down the long sides of the buildings where there's going to be no through traffic at all. And that almost none of the rooms on either of those two quarters of the building connect with each other. They only connect into the passageway through which they're accessed. Also, there seems to have been a intentional desire to not line up any doorways so that you can never have any line of sight through from one space to another space. So it's this attempt to try and generate this privacy that's been lost by the new organization and the need to make this building as quickly and as small as possible. In fact, when you analyze the organization of space, it's more like a modern prison or hospital, and it has a very divergent sort of space syntax to a normal Mesopotamian building. And this is all about using resources in the most efficient way. So though it's a very exceptional Mesopotamian building, it's also shows an adaptation to a need to only use local resources and build quickly and efficiently as possible.
Absolutely. And what lessons do you think this ancient example offers for how architecture might respond now or in the future to limited resources and to the climate emergency?
Well, I think that in some ways it demonstrates that in all circumstances, when we have to find a new way of doing things in order to use less resources, then we might have to give up some cultural expectations of how we live. I think the ability of the ancient Mesopotamians, who were stuck in such a enduring mode of living in buildings, in this courtyard model, which, as I say, persists for 5,000 years, were ready and willing to adapt a building to such a high degree when resources necessitated that they find a new solution. And perhaps we need to be ready now to also consider, you know, new ways of conceptualizing living space and giving up some old expectations and taking on some new ones.
Yes, I thought that was a really powerful vision of a radically different society to our own, confronting some of the same fundamental challenges that we're going to have to confront in the next century, which is, what should architecture look like when constrained by resources? What are the limitations that we have to operate within? And how can we achieve the things that we need as a society from our architecture whilst respecting the ecological settlement that keeps us all alive?
Absolutely. And our next speaker, Rickard Kallid, really looks at that now in architectural practice. She's an interdisciplinary researcher in energy consumption at the University of Cambridge, and her research looks at intersectional approaches to energy consumption and energy justice. So I think she offers really important lessons for what we can be doing now. Can you describe the socio-technical approach to architecture and energy?
Energy is generally linked with architecture through the idea of energy efficiency. Now, we know that buildings account for about 40% of total global energy consumption. And so energy efficient architecture is primarily focused on reducing this energy demand, either through technological or material efficiency or through economic means, such as improvements in building envelopes and construction techniques and appliances and so on. And while this is all clearly important, however, far less attention is given to the actual use of architectural spaces, to how spatial configurations can affect occupants' energy and space use, and vice versa. Now, the key word here is the occupants, that is, the users of the building, who are often overlooked in these more techno-economic focus on efficiencies. Now, there are numerous studies out there that show that variations in behavior and the way that occupants use space can actually result in anywhere between 2 to 6 times more energy consumption in very similar buildings. And so both the technical and the social aspects of architecture need to be looked at to improve sustainability in what is called a socio-technical approach. A socio-technical approach basically looks at both the social and the material structures that are deeply interconnected and hence are mutually dependent. Now, such a socio-technical approach, I think, also opens up questions about difference in spatial access, and also in the unequal distribution of energy resources. For example, in the uneven development of cities, for example, when we think about the difference between the rich and the poor, the urban versus the rural, or the north versus the south, and so on. So the concept of energy justice recently emerged in the literature to address these unequal distributions. And most proponents of this framework argue that energy justice is not just about a fairer distribution of energy access and services, but it also recognizes the diversities and the needs of the most vulnerable and the culturally marginalized and excluded social groups.
Like you said, you're looking specifically at questions around gender in architecture and access to energy. So within the research you do and the spaces that you look at, how do women access and use energy in what I assume are predominantly domestic spaces?
So my research focuses on the social and material structures of domestic energy demand in middle-class housing in the global south, and more specifically in Pakistan. And in particular, I look at the interconnections between domestic practices, technologies, and space use, and how these mutually come to define household energy consumption. And one of the key findings from my research is the gendered nature of energy and space use. So if I talk about the case of Lahore, which is my case study area, so my research shows that this gendering of domestic energy and space use occurs in two major ways. First, if we look at the gender division of labor between men and women, So while men are considered the breadwinners and are traditionally responsible for financial decision making, on the other hand, women play a key role in household management and technology use, in practices related to cooking, cleaning, washing, laundering, caregiving, and all these domestic practices, really. And because women spend more time at home and are responsible for most household chores, this means that they are affected more by the types of energy sources that are available, but also by the reliability of these sources. And so this also means that they have a greater role to play when we talk about energy flexibility and demand management. And so this is the first context. The second thing is that women's energy consumption is very much found to be dependent on the spatial affordances of housing developments. And this is because of the gender division of private and public spheres. Now, if I talk about my own society in Pakistan, cultural norms of privacy, seclusion, and female segregation are very much part of the social fabric. And this is then accentuated by architectural structures through the gender division of space. For example, the idea that the house is considered the ultimate domain of women is very much a part of the society. Now, again, what my study shows is that traditionally, vernacular design practices were actually quite closely aligned with this gendered socio-spatial division. And for example, we can see this in the design of private central courtyards, staggered outdoor openings, and the maze-like, but also inclusively designed urban fabrics. Now, the interesting thing is that contemporary housing, which is based on colonial and modernist influences, actually stands in conflict with these sociocultural norms. For example, if we look at contemporary houses today, they generally have these large glass windows and open-planned living spaces, which don't necessarily provide women with the privacy that they need to perform their domestic practices. Similarly, if we look at the building regulations, we find that they usually mandate these peripheral outdoor spaces instead of internal courtyards. And there are restrictions on the heights of boundary walls. And all of these things tend to make outdoor spaces very difficult for women to use. And so it's design practices like these that can have implications for household energy consumption. Just as an example, so because of these configurations, instead of using daylight, women end up blocking their windows and use artificial lighting, even during the daytime. Or they end up relying on air conditioning instead of natural ventilation. So architectural features like these, such as, you know, the way that the building density and setbacks are mandated, height restrictions, spatial layouts, even in terms of the daylight access and window placement, all of these then have an impact on women's energy and space use. And they can end up increasing household energy demands if they don't specifically cater to women's needs.
So what you're describing, I think, in your research is this intersectional approach to architecture, access to space, and gender. So how does that then impact our understanding of energy and architecture?
Yeah, that's a very important question. So this term intersectionality, it actually accounts for the way that gender intersects or interacts with other social categories of difference, such as income, class, ethnicity, education, religion, and so on, that tend to create dynamics of power and structures of inequality. Just to give you a very simple example, if we look at the urban versus the rural divide, now we can understand that both will have different spatial access and energy use for women. For example, based on the type of infrastructure that is available, the systems of energy provision, but also the socioeconomic opportunities that exist in urban versus rural contexts. Now, if we add to this income or class distinctions, then we can see further distributional differences, for example, between high and low income urban women. So if I bring this back to my own case study of Lahore, So what I found in my research was that an intersectional lens to this gendered nature of energy and space use, it helps us to show that different women in middle-class housing have different agencies in household practices and technology use. And the extent of women's agency is actually determined by the various roles they play as wives, mothers, caregivers, mothers and daughters-in-laws, income generators, and housemaids. So for example, in Pakistan, joint family structures and extended households are quite common. And what this means is that in such households, older women or women in their roles as mothers and mother-in-laws can actually have greater authority as the main household managers. Also, if you're talking about affluent households, energy-related practices can actually be differentially distributed between women as homeowners and women as housemaids. And this can then mean that there is a negotiation taking place between labor-intensive versus energy-intensive practices. For example, if we take the case of laundering, then this can mean either washing by hand, which is done by the housemaid, or using automatic washing machines. Now, in the second case, technology use might mean that it's more energy intensive. But at the same time, this can have a liberating effect for women by reducing their dependency on this external help or by providing better time management, for example, for working women or for single mothers. So what all of this tells us is that women cannot be homogenized into a universal category because there are various historical, material, and cultural factors that sort of together determine the pluralities of women's lived experiences. And of course, this is all interconnected with the building design and the space use. So, for example, having more private outdoor spaces or more accessible public spaces, having safer transportation or more inclusive neighborhoods, or having community-based facilities, all of these can have an impact in producing what Dolores Hayden imagined as the non-sexist city, a city that caters to the differential needs of different women who have different agencies in their energy and space use. And so I believe, and I hope that if there's one thing that I want the audience to take away from this, is that a socio-technical approach that kind of brings in these intersectional perspectives can really help us to understand that housing and energy development can be sustainable and equitable, but only when it addresses the needs of the most marginalized in the community. And when it challenges these unequal gender relations in the intersections of energy and space use.
What I think was really useful about that talk, actually, was that too often when we're talking about energy, it seems very immaterial, seems very difficult to kind of comprehend. But by really pushing it into your day-to-day life, you know, how well insulated is your home and what are the kind of social roles that you play as a person every day? And how does your access to energy restrict or enable you to do things is a really important thing to remember when we're talking about, you know, how many tons of carbon in a ton of concrete or whatever. It can all seem a bit immaterial, but that social domestic context for energy is really important to remember, I think.
Definitely. Like you say, it brings it into the realm of actually how we live in buildings and how we use them and how that is such an important part of architecture, should be an important part of architectural design.
Yeah. Well, there we go. That's our penultimate episode of the series finished. So yeah, given that we've got this collection of episodes out now, it'd be really wonderful if you're listening to this, give us a review on your podcast app. Subscribe so that you don't miss the last episode of the series, and tell people about it. If you are studying at the moment, why not tell your classmates about the podcast? If you are teaching at the moment, why not tell your students about it? I think we've built a little resource here, a little collection of talks from the real cutting edge of architectural research. And we'd love to share them with as many people as possible.
Absolutely. Tell your friends and family. I you know, I'm getting emails from random members of my family talking about the podcast. So it's got a wide appeal. The other thing to remember, of course, is to check out the SAHGB website for all information about what they're doing. And the best ways to support this podcast is to become a member of the SAHGB. There's a wide range of membership benefits, which again, you can check out on the website.
And the link for that will be in the show notes.
Thanks everyone.
Bye-bye.
This podcast has been produced by the Society of Architectural Historians of Great Britain, SAHGB. Established in 1956, we're the leading subject association for architectural history in the United Kingdom. Our educational mission is to promote architectural history inclusively to diverse audiences. Our mantra is all places, all periods, all welcome. We promote knowledge through learning, education, and research. We disseminate that knowledge through programming, content, and publications, and we advocate for the discipline and our members. To find out more about our work and to support our educational mission, please visit our website, sahgb.org.uk, or follow us at the SAHGB on Twitter or on Facebook. We are open to all. This podcast series has been created by Jessica Kelly, Matthew Lloyd-Roberts, and Neil Sashore. The series is produced by Frontier. To find out more about them, visit frontierpodcasts.com.